The one goal, the only reason we set up, was to be the best real estate company in Dubai. And people laughed at us and said, how are you planning on doing that? There are the better homes is around and these other companies, and they're great companies. Today, we're the best company in Dubai. When there is fear in the market, that's when you put your foot to the metal. But not many people have that in their locker to be able to do that.
They kind of do what the market does. So if everyone's selling, they try to sell. If everyone's buying, they try to buy it. But by the time you do that, it's just too late.
Anyone could start a real estate company today, anyone. You know, you can meet someone down the street and they can do it. But being an average real estate company is not worth doing. I'm only here to be the best. If I'm not going to be the best, I might as well pack up. But being around money. Being around money, and then you realise, actually, money's not actually that fun. Once you've got a nice house, a nice family, what's the purpose of money? It's to make a better business or, you know, enjoy life.
What is that one thing you would change about the Dubai's real estate market, if you could?
What would I change?
All right, we're here with another podcast, and this is Dubai Catch. I'm here with a special guest. I always say that the guest himself should introduce and tell us more about who he is.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, Lewis.
Thank you very much. I'll try and keep it within 30 seconds. CEO, well, actually now the chairman of Allsup, and also based on my role change recently and the restructure of the business. We are a real estate business with a mortgage division, conveyancing, foreign currency. I think we're one of the largest real estate companies in Dubai. We're definitely the number one transacted company in Dubai. We've been from a three-man business all the way up to around 650 people today, with a goal in 18 months to get to 1,000-man headcount.
600 people, right?
650.
So, all right. And you're aiming to reach 1,000?
We will reach 1,000. I don't doubt it. I mean, I said this to you off camera before, Dubai is growing. And as Dubai grows, we are an organic business that actually started in Dubai. A bit like Fade Fit and these businesses that you see growing throughout Dubai. We are a local business in growth mode with Dubai. So if Dubai grows, we will grow with it.
Interesting. So you, aside from your business in real estate, what do you enjoy doing? As Lewis, what do you enjoy doing in Dubai?
Well, I'm a father of two. So I have a daughter that's 5 and a son that's 3. All of my time at the weekend is spent with them. So the minute the weekend hits, I don't really see them in the day because obviously they're at school. So we enjoy our weekends, pool, beach. My kids have got a very expensive taste. We have an apartment which we live in at the weekend in the Atlantis Royale. And every weekend it's Nobu. So my kids at 5 have Nobu steak and rice with teriyaki.
Highest quality meat.
It doesn't, unfortunately, when she goes to Tesco's in the UK or somewhere, she's going to be asking questions. But no, I spend most of my time with my family. You know, my life has evolved a lot from 19 years old when I come to Dubai to 38 today. The days of brunches and parties are long gone. My life is business and family.
That's now. That's but before then, when you were 19 years old, starting here in Dubai,
I was a nightclub's best friend. You could say I tasted the nightlife of Dubai, and I don't have any taste to go back into it.
You pretty much got it out of your system, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, look, you go back to 2006-07, there was places like 360 in Jumeirah Beach Hotel, the island in the middle of Jumeirah in the sea.
Yes.
There was a place called Mahiki where I used to spend most of my time. And then we used to go all the way down. This is going to go way back to near Dera, where there was the Lodge and Kiva, which is an open-air nightclub in 2007 or 8. So I've been all over the place with partying. But like I said, I reiterate, them days are now gone.
I feel like those days pretty much wasn't as much luxurious activities as you would compare today, especially 2007, that's when the financial crisis.
So 2006, I came here, January the 4th, 2006. So we probably had 18 months of good real estate, and then we started the business in 2008. But Dubai, definitely, I mean, when I came here, people still class Dubai as the golden city and the place where you make millionaires overnight. So maybe it's not what it is today, because Dubai now you have world-renowned beach clubs and restaurants and hotel brands, you know, everything from the Western to the W to you know, the Atlantis. You know, these places have landed in Dubai from international waters, so it's definitely become more glitzy. But yeah, it's been a journey.
But coming there from UK,
yes,
right? Coming from UK at 19 years old in Dubai, where back then it was very less known as compared to today, yeah. I would say. How did you convince your parents, or did you just take the route and like, hey, I'm going to convince my friend, I don't need to convince anyone, I'm just going to go?
So I wasn't allowed into senior school after 16. They wouldn't allow me in because I was what they call a disruptive influence. I'm not very good in school. I'm not very good in boardrooms. I'm actually good in boardrooms. I'm not good in classrooms.
Did you go to college?
Didn't go to college. Didn't go to university. 16 years old, I went to school. I went to work. And my first job that I had for 6 months is I sold heating and conditioning, air conditioning parts for 6 months, and then went into property. And basically how I ended up in Dubai, I was had my own money, not a lot of it at that point, and a TV program about Dubai, and someone come up on the TV saying, I made £1 million this month, and I was like, whoa. And I made one phone call to an agent in Dubai and just said, look, I'm in real estate or estate agents in the UK. I'm looking to move to Dubai. Would you take me? They said yes. A week later, I jumped on a flight.
So, and then you moved there and you worked for 1 year and a half approximately?
Yeah.
Before starting your own business?
Correct.
So you co-founded this business with your brother, of course.
Correct.
And that's why you name it Al-Also?
Yeah, Also and Also.
Also and Also.
I get a lot of Arab people think we actually delivered soup because all soup. We're not soup, we're real estate. So everything you could say or do with the name has been mentioned before. But yeah, so I did a year in Dubai real estate. I worked for some really good companies learning about the Dubai market. And then in 2008, I remember just saying to my brother, I was like, we can do this. And I remember thinking at the time, bearing in mind I've come from the UK, which had historical backing of, you know, structure and how a business is run. And Dubai was still brand new at that point for, you know, real estate businesses. And they weren't doing morning meetings. There was no hours for companies. There was no paydays. So you got paid every day whenever a deal came into place. There was no key performance indicators, what are called KPIs, for calls and viewings. And I said to my brother, I was like, wow, like if we set a company up and try and be a real estate company, estate agency, we're really going to make a mark. And we stood up, opened the business in 2008, all the enthusiasm of the world, every money that I'd made. And at that point, for 20 years old, I'd made quite a lot of money. I put every bit of money into that business. And the day we got the key for the business for our new office in Al-Wasl Road, the newspaper come up with an Emirati guy with his head in the hand saying world markets crash and every market you could imagine crashed.
So you just started just few months weeks before the finance.
Literally, I was going at that point and hoovering the office, and we were going to IKEA to get the you know, the flowers and these things and trying to get the pictures on the walls. I was doing it all. You know, I actually enjoy that part, but I miss when we set up offices now, not doing that. But yeah, 10 days, 2 weeks into the office, bang. And then you tell anybody, there's a lot of companies that have set up in Dubai in the good market. Let me tell you now, you try and sell a property in a market when everything's crashing around you, and you call them and go, do you want to buy a house? And they're going, really? Are you sure? Were you seeing what's going on? But that ended up being the best thing that happened to me, because every big company in Dubai with big overheads and not great structures ended up cutting costs. And we were just three people in a 5,000 square foot office. And every week and every day, we're chipping away. And we had one goal. The one goal, the only reason we set up was to be the best real estate company to buy. And people laughed at us and said, how are you planning on doing that? There are the Better Homes is around and these other companies, and they're great companies. Today, we're the best company in Dubai.
Interesting. What I've noticed is what you've mentioned just recently, that you started during the financial crisis, mm-hmm. just for sure. When I was also doing the podcast with For us.
Yes.
You started at the same time that you did.
Yeah.
Which is interesting that both of you had this aspiration to start a real estate brokerage and pursue to becoming the best.
Funnily enough, again, I know Firas. I didn't know this till we spoke, but he said he actually came in for an interview at our place.
Really?
And for whatever reason, it didn't happen. And fair play to him. He's gone on to run his business. And I think, you know, if I was to start a business again, I couldn't start Allsop and Allsop Up today and try to replicate. It would be physically impossible because it was the right time, it was the right place, there was the right it was the right niche to hit that market, with Dubai being the way it is today, oversaturated with the real estate agents. Every man and his dog from around the world has flew here to either settle or be a real estate agent. Lewis Allsop wouldn't be able to be Lewis Allsop from 2008. It'd be impossible.
You mentioned that this is the was the perfect time and the perfect moment. A lot of people will not think this financial crisis is the perfect time to start a business, but you started in terms of real estate,
yeah,
which is where everyone's trying to run away from it, and that is really interesting.
In COVID, I remember having video calls with all the property portals. Every company in the property portal, when we were on this video call with everybody, so you can imagine all the agents with the owner of the portals on the call, and they were like, we want to cut the spending. I went off the call. I made a private phone call to one of the top guys, well, the owner of the portal, and said, how much discount are you going to give me if I double my spend? I want to double what I've got. They were like, what? Because I knew that when there is fear in the market, that's when you put your foot to the metal. But not many people have that in their locker to be able to do that.
They kind of do what the market does. So if everyone's selling, they try to sell. If everyone's buying, they try to buy it. But by the time you do that, it's just too late.
It's easy. I mean, anyone could start a real estate company today. Anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, you can meet someone down the street and they can do it. But being an average real estate company is not worth doing. Mm-hmm. I'm only here to be the best. If I'm not going to be the best, I might as well pack up.
For sure. Now, doing this with your brother.
Yes.
How did that work out? Because a lot of businesses that I hear never work with a family member.
Mm.
But you decided to work with your brother and build that partnership and then build this company. How did that work, Roland? Do you have like mixed views?
If you meet my brother, we're polar opposites in work. The first thing I say about working with a family, and I say this to everybody, if you can't trust your family in the world, basically, you might as well give up on the world. You know, your brother is the person that you know you should be going, you know, cradle to the grave with. That's basically where we're at with it. And when we set the business up, because we're yin and yang, I'm gung-ho. I'm aggressive to sell. I am good at selling. I'm good at... Carl calls me, I chuck a grenade in the room and Carl cleans up. That's basically where we're at. Carl is the structure and everything else, and I am the sales side of things. And when we set up, the amount of clashes we had in the first 2 years... because Carl had his opinion, I had my opinion. Carl is older than me by 18 months. Obviously, I'm the younger brother. I had my opinion with more experience at the time. And there was a clash for the first 2 years. And what we came to figure out, and now we just say this, you do you. He knows my strengths. He lets me fly. I do what I need to do to help the business move forward revenue. And I trust Carl implicitly now with the structure of the business and creating a streamlined process. And it just now works. That's why it's been a success.
What drove you actually to take that risk to start this business?
I think that maybe...
Like you could have been comfortable and said, like, you know, I'm just going to continue receiving more funds, you know, settling down maybe financially, getting that stability, and then maybe start a business.
I think the big thing for me, I always had the fear of being average. And I remember when I was 16 in the job, the first one I told you about, that where I was selling heating spares, I used to get on the bus at 5:30, 5 a.m. in the morning. Bear in mind, I was 16 and I'd just left school. What a reality check that was. Freezing cold England at 5 a.m. in December, it's pitch black. It's raining at 5 a.m. and you're waiting in a bus stop. And you're sitting there going, this is not the life for me. I remember going through that process. And I think what I've come to realize is my drive is I fear failure. And I fear, you know, I'll never give up. I should have quit this business in 2008 and 2009 and probably 2010, because for 3 years we made no profit. I was paying staff.
So you're not making any profit for the first 3 years?
Nothing. Because if you have to invest everything back into the business. Every bit of cash flow I had, I put into the business. Then you hire staff. You have to give them half of what you make. At that point, you're then trying to create a brand. You're trying to... So basically, to try and give you an understanding of where the business is at in the first, let's call it, year, we had a five-bedroom office, five-bedroom villa. If you can imagine that. So five bedrooms upstairs, a living room downstairs. The living room was the reception. The back room, the dining table, was the meeting room. We put glass on there. We didn't have a glass door on the ballroom until we made profit, which was month three, until we put a door on there. Upstairs at the five bedrooms, four of them were empty. So we had one sales room with tables on. And then at month four, we opened one door and said, oh, just to let you know, renovation's finished. We put the tables in. Then we did it again and again. So you have to reinvest back into it. At that point, you're trying to build a brand. You know, you're advertising, you're paying, you've got to go over your break even of costs. So for 3 years, if you're not putting everything you have into the business, you're not growing. And then you're just having a business to try and make some money.
That is something that is also a different perspective than most people will do. Once they receive money, they want to spend it as much as possible too. Other than the business, you know, I just received my reward.
Mm.
So I want to spend it on myself to feel better.
Money bores me.
Bores you?
It bores me. It sounds very arrogant saying that, but I've been around money since I was 19. So if you imagine from 19 years old, I've been handling other people's money. So if you imagine a 19-year-old anywhere else in the world, people, when we first set up, were sending us deposits, millions and millions and millions of dirhams that were just in my account. And then I'd have to distribute this money to the sellers and buyers to make sure the international clients had the money. So I've been around money. Being around money, and then you realize, actually, money's not actually that fun. Once you've got a nice house, a nice family, what's the purpose of money? It's to make a better business or you know, enjoy life. But
make your life even better, whether it's health, you know, fitness, your family, relationship, charity, giving. I mean, you can't help people if you don't have the money to help people.
But you get to a point when you've got that. When you live in the nicest house and you've got the best car on the road and you have houses around the world, there comes a point where if you make another million...
Doesn't make any difference.
It's irrelevant. And I'm not saying that, I'm not going to sit on the podcast and say that's exactly where I am. But then it's about how can... my biggest achievement in life, believe it or not, is how can I help other people? I've probably made, in our business, at least 50 people millionaires sterling. You know, I've got people in Jumeirah Golf Estates that live in 30, 25, 28 million dirham houses.
Are they the investors or you mean real
estate? No, they're agents. They've become partners in the company. They've grew with the business. They've bought their own houses and they've gone through the ecosystem of that. And I look at that and think, wow, like I get more from that than I do than going, oh, let's go and buy a new watch or a new car or whatever it may be. It just doesn't excite me. So yeah, I love watching the business grow. And I love watching people grow.
Kind of reminds me of the Maslow's hierarchy. You know how first we want food, safety,
yeah,
and security.
Yeah.
Then we reach at a point where we want, okay, to develop our careers. Then we go further to have a family. And then you go further, now we want to do an impact.
Yeah.
It's like the highest structure of the hierarchy. And the impact comes at the very last day. What can you give and leave a legacy for?
My best things I've done in my personal life in the last few years is I flew my wife's family and her dad for their 60th birth in the private jet to Ibiza.
I've noticed that in your Instagram.
Yeah. In December last year, I took the whole family skiing. I paid for everything, all inclusive, chalet, drinks, food, everything for 7 days. I paid for everything. I've retired my mum. At Christmas, we turned up and bought her a car when it wasn't there to go onto your drive.
Was this just now? Or you
mean in the last 4 years, 3 years. So I look at that, I think, wow, like, I love that I can do that for my family. And I'm proud that I've sacrificed so many relationships and so much time from the age of 19 that now I'm late 30s, I'm starting to see that it was worth it.
Interesting. Do you think it's ever late for someone to be a real estate agent?
Never. Never. The problem is everyone wants it now. Everyone would like to be Lewis Allsop today.
For sure.
But I've been doing 18 years and I've built the foundation of the business. I've invested tens of millions of dollars into marketing, infrastructure, human capital. You know, if I go into my office sometimes and think, wow, the people around me, I have a CFO that's ex-Bank of China. My chief people officer is head of one of the biggest tech companies in the UAE. My sales director, manager director, they're all the highest level you can get. And that takes time to bring them up with you and train them and get to that level or build that business. And yeah, people want it now. I see people, you hit them on the head, they'll drive a Ferrari, but they're just about making money to cover the repayments. That's not how life actually is. And you can't grow from living. There has to be a sacrifice somewhere. And no one's willing to put that time in. They want instant satisfaction. That's what Instagram's worst problem is.
Instagram is like instant gratification. It's like hitting your dopamine every time you see the likes, you see the follows, you see everything. Even myself, I feel sometimes addicted. And I'm aware that like, this is happening, you should stop.
I'm addicted. So I was sitting in bed yesterday laughing at my wife and I'm on the reels and she's just laughing. I'm like, I'm sending her memes and stuff and these videos and I'm laughing to myself and I'm an hour deep into the, I think they call it doom scrolling, basically where you just go through.
Just going and you can't stop. It's like your head's just...
But the algorithm's so good. But this is what a real estate agent is, you know. Real estate agent has the same trap because of real estate, once you taste that really big commission check, you can't go back to a normal job. My top agent last month took home 1.7 million dirhams in his pocket.
In 1 month?
In 1 month. How do you then go back to a job that pays you $20,000?
That's like a paycheck of a high-level CEO in the United States or something.
My wife worked with one of the biggest auditors in the world, and she was really a high-level EA, executive assistant. And obviously, she was privy to the salaries and things like that that come through. And I would tell her what my agents are running. And she was just like, Lewis, you understand, you are this agents that are moaning, they've had a bad month, they're earning more than a president of these companies. Like a bad agent in this market would take home 70,000 dirhams. 70,000, a bad agent. I mean bad, medium to average.
That's a really good, even...
It's incredible. Yeah. But just to give you mathematics...
There's inputting this.
Oh, a lot.
I mean, if you're thinking about the average job, it would work 40 hours a month.
Yeah.
But when it comes to...
It's 24/7.
Agent, you're working like 24/7. You're on the call every time. You're 80 hours.
The question is how many years do you sacrifice to climb the ladder to make 70,000? To give you the mathematics behind real estate, and I'll use Allsup and Allsup as an example, average sale price is just under 4 million. Okay, use that as an example. We charge 4%, 2% to the buyer, 2% to the seller. That means the commission is 40, 80, 160,000. The agent gets half of that. So in one deal, they take home 80,000 dirhams for one average deal. Average. If you do that two or three times, which they do.
But you got to find the right clients.
Which is why you've
got to work. Leads.
But you've got to work for the good company. And that's where the trick's missed. Everyone chases the high commission that doesn't actually bring anything to the party. In this market, you have to work with a company that gives something back to you, not just a laptop and a high percentage.
What about in terms of now the shift in the buyers within Dubai? Do you believe that people are more willing to buy apartments or townhouses these days compared to the past? I mean, let's compare it between the past and back in 2007 to now. Has there been a shift in buyers and what they buy?
Do you know what's interesting? It's the shift of age. So if you look at me as the example, I've been here 17 years. I started in Marina. I then moved a few times to Marina. I then went to Media City. I then went to Victory Heights, then to Jumeirah Golf. So what you can see is as I've got older, I've gone out further with land. And I think what you'll find is Dubai is growing up. Dubai is people that were in Marina, met their partner, they want a villa, they may have a dog, they want a garden. And what you're finding is that the more people that are coming here, it's flushing through people into Marina and starting that cycle for them to grow up with Dubai, to go through that transition. So I think it's very much based on who you are as a person. Is there the deals happening in Marina every day, probably more than anywhere else in Dubai? But is there villa transactions everywhere as well? Yes. It's just based very much on the client.
Interesting. So you would say that just because they're here and they find their partner, then they start to transition to that next life stage, which then they go into finding a villa or townhouse.
I get it. If I was 19 today, honestly, I'd live in the Marina. Or I'd live in downtown because
that's where everything is happening.
I would go to Zuma in the evening in downtown and once a meal, I'd hit the cantilever in the middle with the 11 restaurants in it. Or I'd go to Marina and I'd go to the beach and I'm 19. But as I get older, maybe I want a barbecue. I want my friends over. I can't bother to go out anymore. So life just changes and I think that's how the market fundamentals work.
But when I go to now, like Dubai Marina, usually you will not find much locals going there. You see mostly the expats living there. I see a lot of the buildings that used to be new back then, now it's very old. They're really old when it comes to those buildings. Do you think they'll potentially be renovated? Like they will?
Wish they would do JVR.
Close the building down, tear it down, and then build a new...
I don't think they can ever... The problem is with tearing it down is that they're all freehold. So effectively, someone, let's say if I own the JVR units, I had the right to that land from the ground to the sky. So unless everybody agrees, let's knock the building down, it's probably never going to happen. What's more realistic is maybe they would paint the building. As an example, JBR. I don't like the JBR skyline. I think that having that sandy effect gives quite a dated approach to the building, especially when you see some amazing buildings that are launching these days. I mean,
yes. I'm seeing like some modern buildings compared to the old buildings that look sandy a little bit.
Correct. So I don't think that will change. I think maybe they can upgrade them, but I think the location is key. I think that's
maybe the exterior instead of the interior they can update.
Maybe. It's just I think it's more of a paint job than anything else.
For sure. And how do you see like the I'm seeing there's a trend where real estate is now becoming more community-based. Mm. Every place that you go, there's securities, and then you have to go into that security. You have to belong to that community. Mm. So it feels like everything is being segregated. You're part of this community, and you only can be part of that community if you live there. Yep. You can't go there. What's your thought on that? Is this going to create an impact?
I think it creates safety, which is the reason people are here.
But it's already safe. Why do you need that extra safety?
I think, let's say, for instance...
It's like barrier to entry, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know, but I think the main thing is that how do you quantify who's in, who's out of there? So, for instance, one of the things in any community is they have a pool, they have basketball courts. If you go into your home area and then someone that doesn't live there is on your court, you're like, what is going on? So I do like the fact that it's a gated community. I mean, we have an apartment in London. We use that. They are community focused in London. So, for instance, they have community days, but it's not gated. They'll say, bring the community down. We'll have a kids day. They'll go to the park. They'll get the jumping balloons out and the bouncy castle and everything. But it's still open. I think Dubai's strength is that there is a quantifiable knowledge for who's in the area. So why Dubai is safe compared to the UK? Emirates ID. Emirates ID, you go to the mall, they know your face, it scans. They know your blood type. They know how much you earn. Your tenancy contract is linked to your Emirates ID. Your salary,
everything is linked to your Emirates ID.
Which means if we have a fight outside, not me and you, they will know in 2 seconds of face recognition who the guy is and then where he lives. If you lose that chaos and you bring that chaos into Dubai, you would have the same problem with England, where people walk into a street with a balaclava, rob what they want, and there's no repercussions. Dubai works because you stick to their rules. And I like that there is control to what Dubai is.
I believe it's not only the system, because if they, let's say you implemented the system in London or UK, you still have to change the mindset of people.
Agreed.
That's the hardest part. How do you change the mindset of people to be respectful of the laws that are here? And the only way they can be respectful here because Dubai is giving them that opportunity.
Correct.
Like, you got the chance to live here and build your dream, or you got the chance to come here and just enjoy for a certain period of time, come broke, and then you return back to your
lots country. Of them. Yeah, I don't know. I just think Dubai offers the opportunity. Maybe the UK doesn't with the high taxes. I mean, I just seen recently the new Prime Minister of the UK is saying that the finances in the UK are in a dire strait and they maybe need to increase taxes again.
Again.
Which means that you're paying VAT on what you spend, you're being taxed on what you brought. And then when you die, you lose nearly half of your assets to income tax, to death tax. The whole ecosystem for the UK is not built for communism. It's not built for success. It's built for the governments. You know, in Dubai, what I love, and I see it so many times, whether it's emiratization, the government act, they're looking for them to perform. I've seen Sheikh Mohammed come out and say, you know, these divisions are the worst performing government sectors. And that's brilliant. Someone is looking at that. Imagine that in England. They'd be like, you can't say that about our business. Dubai is all about ownership. And I love that.
It's always about also maintaining that best standard, international standard. And trying to be number one. I mean, when it comes to the Dubai ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, he's always envisioning way ahead how I can make this city the happiest city in the world, the smartest city in the world. So not only in terms of the people's well-being, but as well in terms of technology. And you're seeing it happening. It's not just talk.
Yeah.
You're seeing the actions being implemented. When AI was just in like, we had a minister of AI before even AI was that high trend. So you can see how far ahead we're thinking in terms of what type of plans already placed to have Dubai or have UAE as a whole thrive.
Yeah.
Thrive for the better security of the place, of this country.
I think last year I met the CEO of Dubai Future, Kaflan Badhul.
So
I went and met him and we were chatting, having a coffee, and he was just going through what the whole purpose of that division is. And when you see what they're doing, they're trying to build businesses to push barriers of Dubai and the future of Dubai. Now, that's just incredible. Like, you don't see that anywhere else in the world. And you hit the nail on the head. Dubai tries to be number one. And I think if you have that mindset, which you heard me say at the start, I won't be open if I'm not trying to be number one. Them type of people make Dubai.
And that's right, for those type of people to appear to buy. For sure. Now, going into the real estate business, I mean, you have this vast experience of 17 years. How important would it be between choosing a location and between having the property condition? We can have the best location, but with the property that aged 10 years or more, or we can have a property that is new, but it's just far away, you know, all the way in Arjan or somewhere else. Just away from the city main.
So the first thing is, a lot of people, you'd be surprised, do go further out. Dubai South 3 years ago was no one's cup of tea. No one's. As rents and prices crept up, what you see if you've went, so I can get a garden if I go 20 minutes out. Now 20 minutes out, or 25 minutes, it's nothing in England. People do that commute. I used to commute 45 minutes. Like, people do commute from London 2 hours in the morning. It does happen. So I think what you'll find is that location, yes, is important, but it's also, what is it you need in your life? We said at the start about the family or the dog or whatever it is they're looking for. There are people today that are just going, I've lived in an apartment 5 years. I have to have a garden, non-negotiable. And they will sacrifice the location for the house. So I think the number one thing for people is what the bedrooms and their needs are. And number two will be location. You'll be surprised. I think 3 out of 4 transactions that we do may register in one area and buy another area. And that's a broker's job. And that's what I think people think brokers, their main role is to pick up the phone and go, when do you want to view it? No, no. Our job is to say, tell us how much you want, how much you want to spend, what are your key features, and then offer them something maybe they didn't know. That's real estate.
I've noticed that you mentioned that this is in terms of a buyer's perspective, that he wants to live in this home. But what if you're an investor? Would you choose somewhere in the main downtown, or to choose those places, as you mentioned, for a little bit far away, 25 minutes, 30 minutes, townhouse?
I think you'll choose.
And there's this trend now that's happening with Airbnb style, like subleasing, and then trying to sublease multiple apartments in the downtown, just with the tourism going up.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think it can be very lucrative if you know how to systemize it and make it really well. Because it's, in the end of the day, it's all about customer service.
Yeah.
It's about reviews. And it's really about building that brand image for yourself and how you maintain those apartments.
I see it on Instagram. There's a couple of people I follow. I don't know, never met them. But they basically got 50 or 60 properties in Dubai. They don't buy them.
They don't buy
them. They just straight out lease them and then sublease them back out. And I think around the world, it's very popular. It's very, very popular. And I understand why, because it's cash flow generating. It's effectively as good as buying a property and then renting it out. But effectively, you're not buying it.
You're getting 10 instead of 1.
Correct.
You know what I mean?
Correct. So you're using no real capital to buy the property, and there's no commitment for 25 years. So you could rinse and return that on a mass volumes. The more I'm saying this, the more I'm thinking I should be doing this, because I'm not doing this. There's definitely a market there for it.
For sure, for sure. I think this is like something you can capitalize now, especially in Dubai, because Dubai is a city for tourists.
Correct.
There's always going to be demand for places to stay for a short period of time. Not a lot of people are fond of hotels. They want to have somewhere bigger space than a hotel would provide. Like, a hotel will provide 200 square feet to 300 square feet.
Really?
The studio, you can go from 600, 700, correct, and you can go to 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom.
We have a holiday homes division, so we haven't got like thousands of units, but it does very well, and that occupancy is 98%.
And how do you do most of the marketing for that? Do you go
booking.com, Airbnb, we go to these places. That's it.
You don't do like sponsored ads or
don't need to do anything, because basically the portals have enough traffic to be able to create the demand. So the biggest problem is we don't have enough properties. So if you are a landlord listening to this and you want short-term rent, call me.
Definitely catch up with them. For sure. So what's your take on the current supply and demand on the Dubai's property market?
So in 2019, I went onto the radio, 2020, with Brandy Scott and Richard Dean on Dubai Eye. And I remember going on there and saying to them, it's undersupplied, dramatically undersupplied. And they were like, you're the only person to say that. I said, just wait and see. My population statistics show me. There's no doubt about it. I think 10 years ago, we were at 2.2 million. We're now at 3.7 million. We're growing over 100,000 people, minimum 150,000 population every single year. And it's not going to go down. And then how many handovers? I think the year before was 40,000. This year we might hit 100,000 if we're lucky. So the key cocktail for Dubai is not, are we undersupplied? It's like, we're definitely undersupplied. I don't doubt that for a second. The price dynamics going up like this shows you this. The question is, how long are we going to be undersupplied for? And I don't believe we're launching enough to keep up with the demand of Dubai's success. And that's my honest opinion. I think the population growth, probably within 5 years, will hit 200,000 every single year with the way that we're going. Because if Dubai continues to be tax-free, if corporation tax stays low and the safety's there, and then you go into America, UK, Spain, wherever you're going, and you're seeing what's going on in these places, Dubai becomes a very interesting place to live. So I don't see the market cooling down anytime soon because we don't have enough properties. So long may that continue.
For sure.
But not too much.
But I see that also there was a trend about saying that a majority of the handovers of supplies of units will be provided by 2025 to 2026.
Yeah.
A lot of projects that started in the COVID time would finish by then, by 2025, 2026. But when it comes to all the supply, I still, as you said, I see that there's an increasing trend in tourists coming here, tourists loving this place, and then they, instead of becoming tourists, they're residents. There you go.
Which is the cocktail. This is the special thing about Dubai. You come here and you fall in love with it, and then you want to be part of it. So it's not that Dubai is the best property market, the one everyone should invest here. There is an ecosystem that people need to understand about Dubai, and it's how Allsup and Allsup really works. We register 5,000 clients a month. Out of the 5,000, probably 3,500 are tenants. They really go, that's rentals, that's not massive money. Brennan will be going 17 years now. If we work out this, you become a tenant, we register as a tenant. We have got automations and triggers in place to call you. Once you're a tenant, you go to renew. I know you're probably going to get a mortgage for us, so we'll call you. Hey, you're telling us about doing a mortgage. Yes. You then become a buyer. But what happens in 5 years? You become a seller, and the seller becomes a buyer, and the buyer becomes a seller. And what you're doing is we're pouring more and more tenants into the market to continue that ecosystem. That's where Dubai is.
You build that ecosystem.
Yeah, we build. We've got the triggers and automations and technology and AI that we have in place at the moment is second to none. But where the real strength is, the amount of leads that we generate. I said before, we generate 5,000 customers a month. This is not cold calling. This is not anything other than people inquiring on our properties to rent, buy, sell, manage, maintenance, mortgages, whatever it may be. We have their phone number, email address, data, where they live, and then we're able to convert that into our clients.
But you said most of them are from here. They're not actually leads coming from overseas.
Correct. I'd say 90% of my business is Dubai-based.
Okay. And you're advertising mostly Dubai-based. You're not advertising to overseas leads, I would say.
So we spend about, I think we spend about $100,000 a month on Google PPC International.
Okay.
So that gives you an idea with that. So we'll always go to, we'll look at the demographics where people are buying from. People are buying in the UK, Spain, US. We will target keywords for Google on there. But generally, most of the AE spend is there, you know, to buy property, to buy rent property, to buy. If you go onto the search engines, we're on the top page for organic searches for most of the keywords in Dubai.
How do you see in terms of the financing options that are available in Dubai? So let's say, for example, a mortgage. I got a mortgage, for example, for my apartment that I live in Maidan.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, I think about like the 25 years or the 20 years that I'm going to pay. And the interest cost of this. A lot of people say, just, you know, try to finish as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Finish the mortgage. Finish it in 5 years instead of 25 years or 20 years. What's your thought on that? Should person save their money, go buy another property, or should they continue to, you know, finish their mortgages as soon as possible and then start purchasing another property?
I would never, ever finish my mortgage early. Ever. I mean, let's be honest, but let's call it a 5% interest rate at 20 years, hypothetically. Technically, you're paying this double, the same price as the purchase price. So 100% of the value of the mortgage. So if you get $1 million property, you're going to pay $1 million over 20 years in interest.
Yeah.
That's a given. So you just got to take that on the chin. Two things you need to know. First of all, owning a property, you're in a better place than renting. Because first of all, you're paying your own mortgage. And this is what people seem to miss. If you own a property in Maidan and your mortgage is 10,000 dirhams a month, you are paying out of that 10,000, hypothetically, 5,000 to interest, and 5,000 a repayment. So you're going to do that for 5-10 years. Now, what you secretly won't know is that 5,000 dirhams have been stuffed away into your back pocket because you're actually paying yourself. You're not paying the mortgage. But the other thing to remember is that inflation over the world always goes up 1-3-5% a year. Now, what inflation will never disappear. You know, we need to earn more money. Properties need to go up in value. The cost of bread and coke will always go up, which makes the value of money less. That is always going to be there. What happens in that world? Property will go up. So if you want to beat the interest rates, just live in your house and let the property value go up. Me personally, I bought properties over the last 3-5 years, have been the best investments of my life. Just owning houses, the best investors live in the house you've got and watch inflation and property prices continue to increase.
But how far can it increase? If you think about, like, let's say about a property, you have an apartment that's 7 years old, but by the time 10 years later, it's 17 years old. Don't you think it will cost a lot to maintain it? And
my property in London was built in 1700s.
Oh, wow.
So it is what it is. I think structurally, they'll be fine, unless someone can tell me otherwise. And then it's just the maintenance of the building. So there are buildings all around the world. Like, Dubai was building properties in 2006. They've not done it blindly. They would have took architects' advice and builders' advice and gone through the whole. People have this thing, and I do hear it internationally, these properties won't be around in 10 years. Okay, well, they're around in Florida. They're around in Vegas. They're around in Texas. They're also 100 degrees and 100 Fahrenheit, whatever it may be. So I don't know, like, answer to your question, just live in your house, just enjoy living in it, and the inflation will always kick in. But remember this, if you go back to your parents and ask them what they bought their first house for, it'd probably be 100,000 dirhams or 150,000 dirhams. My parents bought their house, the first house, they told me, for £18,000. That house today is worth like £600,000. That's not going to change. Probably you're 30 when you tell me off camera. Go remember what your first chocolate you bought, whatever it may be. Mine was like a Freddo or something along them lines. They were like a penny. They're now 25p or a dirham. They're now 10 dirhams. The value of money is becoming less, and that's never going to change. That's because crypto has come into place. That's because people are printing money in different avenues because property has gone up so much. When you inherit your family's business later on in your life, or my family's assets, we would go to sell it, which would give us a windfall. That windfall is actually devalued over years. So it's just understanding that concept that money's not going anywhere. The more you gain, the less it becomes valuable.
It's like, instead of saving it, you should use it as a tool to build your asset.
So I have very limited money in my bank. Very, and I tell everybody this. I can call on money in 8 minutes, so I'll have the money back to me. My money's in fixed deposits, shares, properties, anything income generating, or anything that I think is going to come value. So one of the things I invested in quite big last week was Salik. My logic with Salik is that
IPO?
Yeah, well, it's already on the market, free trading now. And the reason I did it is my logic was, I like the business, I like the model. Are there more people coming to Dubai? Can they potentially charge more for Salik? Are the roads going to get busier? Yes, yes, yes. That business, if I put money into it,
self-sustaining, it just keeps going, because they always have to go through that route.
So if you've got money in your bank and you've got, let's call it 100,000 dirhams, put that money into Salik, put that money into fixed deposit, you win.
But how much money you should keep as a hold, just for any emergency fund?
3 months. The reality is, it goes back to the same thing. You should be able to call the money you've got at any time. Like, I don't have year fixed deposits. I don't have year assets. I could call money from these places very quickly. Not that I would have, in my 18 years of real business, I've never needed it, but I've just learned, and I said this on the last podcast, the poor spend, the middle class save, the wealthy invest. If you remember that saying, you know why the wealthy are wealthy. They invest.
For sure. But they invest in the right things.
That's a crystal ball.
And that can sometimes happen with network, like the people that you have around you. It's not easy that everyone has access to people who are doing this for a living, for example, the ones who are day trading, the ones who are in stock market. So having those network of people, there's always that saying, you're the average of the 5 people you spend your time around with. So if you spend with people who are thinking about money, thinking about real estate, thinking about this, I'm sure you're going to learn something.
But they do fail. I mean, I could tell you now, like, I've had some incredible successes in the last 4 or 5 years, stuff that's irrevocably changed my life outside of also, and also in investment and property. But 2007, I bought Dubai Waterfront. I bought a full floor in Waterfront. I lost so much money in that. I've bought other stuff that just hasn't worked. I've bought crypto that went down 99.7%. I've done stuff like, but the key thing is I've tried it and I've pulled the trigger. Sometimes it fails, but sometimes it's, but some people don't want to pull trigger at all. They want to sit on the fence.
It's a risk. You have to take that risk. I mean, you took the risk of starting that business. You took the risk to come to Dubai while everyone was in the UK, staying where they are, you know, comfortable space, comfortable zone. You took out of the zone and just went to started something new totally in another city that no one very much knew about it before.
Biggest and best risk I ever took in a nightclub, going to my wife, was, didn't know at the time, and said hello. And that turned into two kids, an amazing marriage, and a future. And that is a risk because you go into that club and they say no to you and they don't want to talk to you. It's not a good place to be. So everything in life that we talk about, there has to be a risk and reward factor. There has to be. And if you take the risk, sometimes the reward's worth it.
Sure. I think you should not fear risk as much.
Agreed.
As long as it doesn't kill you, like they say, it makes you stronger, you know? Now, there's another great question that I'm curious to see from your perspective with that vast experience. When do you know it's the right time to sell a property? How do you know?
So I'm going through this at the moment myself at the moment. So I've got a property I bought and I'm trying to rent it at the moment and I'm also trying to sell it. And it's just handed over. It's a luxury apartment. It's very nice. And I just can't work out if I should sell it or not. And I don't think I will. And this will give you the logical answer behind what it is. Once I've bought that property, that money is gone for me. That money I don't want to touch. I just want to receive the reoccurring revenue every single month. I have never, ever sold a property unless I've rebought for another one. Never.
So you sell a property and then you buy something else?
Bigger, better, or whatever, different type of investment. But I've got friends that have sold a property and then bought a Range Rover.
Mm-hmm. Those depreciating asset. Yeah.
There's no purpose in it. So my answer to everybody is that no one, once you've bought a property to invest in, unless you found something else you think is going to turn into another type of investment, put that property to the side and try and save for another one. The key, if you can get two or three properties going at the same time, it's not just the rental income, it's the capital appreciation of 5%, 5% on each property going, all of a sudden that wealth starts to accumulate. Sure. So don't sell unless you have to.
Sound advice.
And that's an estate agent saying that. I should be saying to you, sell. I mean, real estate.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. If you were really thinking in terms of business perspective, that you would the advice. As a leader in your own real estate brokerage, how do you balance between the need for growth while maintaining that culture and sustaining that culture that you envisioned for this company? Because it's hard when you're scaling and keeping that standard and quality that you had in the very beginning.
It's massively hard. Anybody listen to this running a business? 100-man business is so different to a 500-man business. And the reason for 100-man, you control the narrative yourself. I've been in boardrooms, meetings with my team. I talk, I give my opinion. That's what it is. And people understand it comes from my voice. When you get so big, and this is the level we've been at, where I've got 5 offices on a monthly meeting on a Google Meet, you can't have the same impact. And I've been through this about a year ago where I seen our culture and our business not going the way that I wanted it to go. And at that point, it had to make some moves to create the company that I wanted. So one of them, without going too much detail, is we had multiple branches all around Dubai.
How many branches do you have now?
Now we've got 5.
Fine.
But at one point we had 13, 14. Fine. And I didn't like it. Because what you find is everybody's got a different viewpoint. So what I decided to do, if you look at the best companies in the world, Google, Amazon, Tesla, Apple, they have super offices. So we went and acquired and bought 2 floors, by the third at the moment, in a tower called Control Tower in Motor City. There's 29,000 square feet between them 2 floors. We moved everybody into there. And what that gave us is the ability to be able to speak face to face, create the culture. Because what you'll find when you grow a business, the best people need to run the new people to build, suck the energy off each other, the knowledge. But when they start becoming distorted, you start to lose the culture because the culture is the people. It's the, what they believe in, what that, you know, what they've seen from you. And when that no longer exists, they sort of make their own culture. And then you've got to be able to drag that back. And that's been very hard. That happened to us in COVID. COVID, we gave people more time to themselves. We let people work from home. We let people do certain things. And we pulled that all back. And it wasn't very popular, but it was the best move we had made in our business, because what we've seen is that we were hiring new people and they were in the office and the person they're meant to be sitting next to just wasn't in. And they're trying to learn. How do I learn if the good people are not there? So we've been through that, and my message to everybody is you've got to have really, really strong values for what you think is good for your business, not good for the employee.
And you got to push against the resistance.
Not if you want to say no. There's a lot of people that run businesses want to be the yes man, but the best people that run businesses do what's good for the business. And my chief people officer said something to recently, the people who are in this business have to have the business first, and not everyone's got that in Dubai. That's for them first.
Sure. It's like instead of trying to think about how they can add value to people, they think about themselves, what value it adds to them.
And they feel that, I think a lot of companies would fear losing their staff. I don't want to lose people, but my company becomes way before one person or two people. I know how the company's become successful. I know where it's going to go, but it has to be in the vision that I have. And if people are not on that same boat as me, then we're not going to the same destination. And that's basically how you run a business.
Coming to a conclusion,
What
is that one thing you would change about the Dubai's real estate market if you could?
What would I change? I mean, I should stand here and say less agents, less brokerages, but if Dubai gets bigger, I think you've just got to go with it. One thing that I would change... It's difficult, and this is the honest truth, is that, you know, my career in Dubai has been explosively successful, and everything that Dubai is and Dubai real estate markets probably helped me be who I am. So I'm going to sit on the fence and say I wouldn't change anything, and I hope that it continues. The only thing that we're working on is we're working closely with the government to make sure that best practices are put into place and open communication lines with them. And we have a great relationship with His Excellency Marwan bin Galita and the team to give our opinions on what's going on in the market. And I think that just needs to continue.
You mentioned also that you've did some collaboration in terms with the DLG.
Yes.
In terms of a program supporting amortization.
Yep.
Way. Could you tell a little bit more maybe to the audience that are listening?
Definitely. So we have signed a partnership with the Land Department. We're specifically looking for Emirati talent. And I honestly believe it's an incredible opportunity for us. And for the Emiratis, because what you'll find is that people that are born here, they know the best locations. They've actually went to school, probably some of the biggest investors and contacts in Dubai. And I think if we can get these guys on board, understanding what real estate is in our culture, as in it's no longer, you know, a handshake. The whole market has changed dynamically. And we've had some incredible workshops with some incredible talent where we're explaining what the real estate market really is, because now it's about prospecting, speaking to sellers, going through what their needs are. So we're looking forward to hiring some of the best talent, and if anybody is looking, we're happy to sell some interviews.
Absolutely. And going to the final question, What has been the most rewarding aspect of your career? What would you say that after the 17 years you've been here in Dubai, building that business, doing real estate, what was the most rewarding part?
There's a few factors. I think number one is financial freedom. I think that's a big part of it. But if you take finances out of it, you've then got the people that have changed their lives irrevocably, working at Allsup and Allsup. But I think the third thing for me, what I've enjoyed the most, is living in Dubai. I think people really don't understand that. Like, I was selling stumps in the ground at the Burj Khalifa and selling payment plans off floor plans in 2006. And then you sell the Palm Jumeirah when they weren't ready, the villas weren't ready. And you go through this thing of seeing Dubai evolve and grow, and people are, oh, it's so glitzy and shiny. Like, it wasn't like that when I was here. So my biggest rewarding thing is, I think Dubai being the best city in the world, it's grew up around me and I've grown up with it. And I like that.
So it feels it's your home.
It is my home.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here.
You too.
Thank you so much. I think a lot of the audience learned so much about the real estate industry here. And maybe next time we'll catch up again.
Definitely.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.